Earl Craig presented his intellectual autobiography as the first talk in a series entitled Coming to Truth on January 9, 2008 at McKinsey Study Center's Wednesday night class. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2008. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
The idea of the series this quarter is to learn what we can from people's individual journey, their story, their narrative. This is not a traditional testimony. That is, we're not asking them to tell the story of their relationship with God and how God got their attention and that kind of thing. That may come up along the way, but we're really focusing on the issue of the intellectual journey. So what I've asked the people to do this quarter is to give their intellectual autobiography with respect to the truth of Christianity. That is, how did they come to understand and believe and embrace the idea that Christianity is the truth? And that's what all of our speakers will be in their own particular way addressing. The speaker tonight is a guest to us here in Eugene. He comes from Southern California. He's on the board of Gutenberg College. He's been a friend of mine for a number of years and has been a pastor of a church in Southern California, and he's now free of that and is a kind of a freelance, have Bible, will travel type guy. his name is Earl Craig, and I'll turn it over to him.
Thank you. Good evening to all of you. As we were driving over in the car tonight, I think it was Jody who mentioned that, you know, Earl, this is your story, your intellectual journey, and you could say whatever you want, and people probably wouldn't know the difference between what's true and what's not. So I can make something up tonight, and it could just be this incredible story of some unbelievable intellectual journey, and be very entertaining to you. Or I could just go ahead and tell my own story, and so I think that's what I'm going to do. It's been an interesting exercise for me to prepare for this for tonight. I would recommend it to all of you that just you sit down and maybe over the course of a few days or weeks or months, what have you, and think about the journey that you've taken in your mind, not just in your heart or in your life, but just in your mind when it comes to your own personal faith. Because it's been a very helpful exercise for me besides. I'm going to start by telling two stories that from my life fairly recently that help to illustrate the main point that I want to make tonight. The first story comes from just a few weeks ago when my wife and I went to a non-denominational church in the Newport Beach area, and we heard the senior pastor there teach on the subject of the peace of God and what that really means for us as Christians. And he told a lot of stories, and he referred to several passages from the Bible, so that in effect we were presented with a variety of dots to connect. You can just kind of imagine that. And I noticed something interesting as I started to try to connect the dots that he was presenting us from the stories that he was telling, as well as from the passages to which he was referring, that depending upon one's assumptions and presuppositions about God, about reality, about life, that a person really could connect those dots in many different ways and therefore understand him to be saying different things about what the peace of God really is. So I could have ended up connecting those dots in such a way that I really had the same knowledge that of the peace of God that he had. Or I could connect those dots in such a way that I come up with a different knowledge of the peace of God, largely depending upon my presuppositions and my assumptions with regard to Christianity. In addition, he was presenting us with new ideas that we had not encountered for example, his stories. I'd never heard his stories before, so all of a sudden there are these new ideas coming at me, as well as some old ideas from the Bible. Having been around the Bible as long as I have and heard sermons and been in Bible studies, a lot of the things that he was saying, they were old ideas too. And so each of us out there in the audience was adding to our knowledge of just reality in life. The stories that he was telling, those were new ideas and we're adding to our knowledge. Or we could have even been changing our knowledge. Let's say, for example, that some of those old ideas that I mentioned from the Bible, perhaps he was saying, you know what, the biblical text means such and such. And yet I had thought that it meant, you know, something different. And I became convinced that he was right and I was wrong. Well, then I would change my knowledge with respect to that particular passage. So the key words from this story that I want to mention to you are same knowledge, different knowledge, adding to our knowledge, and changing our knowledge. So keep those in mind. The second story comes from also fairly recently, and just this last summer, I met someone, another Christian. I hadn't met him before. And he and I found that we just enjoyed sharing our lives and experiences, our ideas with each other. And so we've had an ongoing conversation with one another over the last few months and over several lunches where we're talking to each other about Christianity and specifically about how we expect God to work in our lives as 21st century Christians. Now, his theology is such that he says that we should expect God to work pretty much in exactly the same way that God worked in Jesus and the apostles' lives, where we should expect miracles to be occurring in our lives and in the lives of others with whom we come in contact as Christians. My theology, at least at this point, is such that I think that God worked more in Jesus' experience and the apostles' experience with respect to miracles than he does in our experience as 21st century Christians. So I think that God definitely does perform miracles. Now, I've seen some. In fact, people have accused me of having the gift of healing. I have actually prayed for people in hospitals where they have been ill, and the next day they've been well. And the doctors have no explanation for how they became well, except the person for whom I prayed said, well, Earl prayed for me last night. So we can talk about that some more later on if you want. But in any event, we can definitely do that too. So, but I think that the life of a modern Christian is really more one of struggling with just the problems of life, including our own sin, as opposed to expecting God to work in miracles as often as my friend thinks that he is going to. So that what we're waiting for is for our being transformed into morally perfect people, where we will never have to struggle with things such as depression or bad habits or disease or other problems that we experience in life. That my friend thinks that we should expect him to release us from those problems in this life. Well, he's having me read Don Williams' Start Over, if you're familiar with that author and that book, that supports his view. And I'm having him read Ron Julian's Righteous Sinners and Jack Crabtree's The Tao of Faith that I think support my view. But here's the catch. A third party listening to us in our conversations, especially at the beginning of the series of our conversations, might think that we're not even close to being on the same page theologically. But the more that we carefully define our terms, actually the more that we're finding we really are on the same page. It's really interesting, almost kind of bizarre. So we have a lot of the same knowledge and some different knowledge. And we're trying to figure out who is right and who is wrong with respect to the different knowledge. And I'm finding myself really fascinated by the differences in ideas that he and I hold to be true, and the similarities as also we in areas where we might not even think that we have them. So the key words in this story, same knowledge and different knowledge that the two of us had. So with those phrases and key ideas, let me just go ahead and state to you right now what the main point is of my intellectual journey and what I'd like you to go away with tonight. Think of your knowledge, and I didn't think about this before, but no, okay, we don't have a whiteboard, but I can, you can imagine your mind. Think of your knowledge as a pie chart. Remember pie charts from high school mathematics? Think of your knowledge as a pie chart with most of the pie representing true and accurate knowledge about reality. No matter who you are, you don't even have to be a Christian, but I would suggest that most human beings, their pie chart, most of that chart is true knowledge. Not too many people are going to say you don't exist in this room. Not too many people are going to say that that chair doesn't exist. So for most people, for everyone, most of their knowledge, most of your knowledge is actually true knowledge. Nevertheless, there is a slice of that pie that represents false and inaccurate knowledge about reality. Even though each of us thinks that our entire pies represent true knowledge. Because if we come into contact with something that's false knowledge, well, we'll change that into true knowledge. We'll change our minds. So the sizes of the pieces of the pie, of the true and false knowledge, I would suggest are always changing too. So the two things are true about our human knowledge. First of all, as we pursue truth, even and perhaps most especially biblical truth, our own true knowledge of the truth grows and changes over the course of time, because none of us ever has a complete and accurate knowledge of reality. Or at least our true knowledge should grow and should change, depending upon what kind of Christian environment that we place ourselves into. And here you can tell I'm putting a plug in for Gutenberg College, because the kind of environment that we want to provide for you here is one where you can add to your knowledge and even change your knowledge too. So that's the first thing that is part of my main point. Secondly, with regard to human knowledge, that we find that our knowledge is always different, even if only slightly, from that of other people. Nobody's knowledge pie is exactly the same as anyone else's pie. And so either to expect or to demand that others believe or think exactly the same way we do is unrealistic, and I would suggest even unloving. Instead, we are always at different places on the journey towards truth, and we need to allow one another to be in a different place on that journey. And I'm calling this main point the vicissitudes of human knowledge. Vicissitudes means changes, and I'm adding something to that meaning. I'm adding the notion of differences to it, implying both the changes that take place in our knowledge of reality over time, as well as the differences that exist in our knowledge, each one with respect to another human being. I could also call this main point learning to live with uncertainty and error in the midst of certainty and truth. I need to recognize, and we all need to recognize, that by definition, some of my knowledge is false. Now, I won't admit that necessarily all the time, especially to my wife and my kids, but I'll admit it to you. Some of my knowledge, by definition, right now, is false knowledge. But I'm uncertain. I don't know as to which of it really is. And so I have to live with this fact in the midst of what I am certain is true. Or at least I hope it's true, which should all lead me to a deeper humility. But just as each of us has a different knowledge pie, no one has the right or authority to tell you what part of your knowledge is correct and what part is wrong. It is your responsibility alone before God. So the only person really who has the right to correct your knowledge is God through the Bible. Therefore, the Bible is our only authority and source of truth about God and the other concepts that are discussed within the Bible. That's my main point. There's a sub-point, though, that I want to mention, too. That in the midst of the changes and differences in our human knowledge, what really counts is that we are pursuing truth with a growing awareness of our moral condition before God, as well as a growing awareness of God's grace and mercy, somehow, some way, making its way towards us through the gospel of Jesus Christ. So that whatever inkling that we have of what the truth is, what Christianity is, we should run with it until we discover otherwise and grow and or change in our knowledge. So that's the sub-point. Now, before I get to my story, just a couple of definitions maybe, just to make sure that perhaps we are at least a bit on the same page. Let me define for you the word idea, because that's what we're talking about. An intellectual journey is a journey of ideas. An idea is a mental impression, an image, a thought in our minds, where we conceive of something, be it a chair, or a human being, or a concept such as goodness or morality. That's an idea. Well, what about truth? Well, truth, I think, is that which is in accordance with reality. When our ideas, the ideas in our minds, the impressions, the images, the concepts in our minds, when those line up with reality, both outside of us as well as inside of us. That when I have the idea of a chair, that the image in my head is in accordance with what is actually there, that chair. Then I have an idea that's a true idea. Let me also define for you the word plausible. This is a new word for me, and I'm having fun kind of playing with it because I'm thinking about this whole notion of plausibility. Plausible is when an idea seems reasonable or probably true. Something is plausible when we embrace an idea as true because it seems reasonable for us to do. It just makes sense that we would embrace that idea is true. Then also the word knowledge. Knowledge would be ideas that I have in my mind that I think correspond to reality inside and outside of me. So I can either have true knowledge or false knowledge for that matter. And then the word understanding. Understanding would be the grasping of the meaning and significance of my knowledge, of the ideas in my mind, in order to live life. In other words, when I've connected the dots in my mind in such a way that I can live life based upon those ideas, that's understanding. And then finally, wisdom. Wisdom would be exercising well my understanding, my good and accurate understanding, hopefully, a proper understanding of a true understanding of life, where the connection of the dots in my mind is the right way to correct those dots. When I use those connections well to live my life, I could be said to be living life wisely. Now, let me get to my story then. How did I arrive at all this stuff? Well, let me go back, first of all, to my early years, grade school through high school. I was not necessarily what one would call a child philosopher, deeply curious about the big questions of life. Why are we here? What's the purpose of life? I was just a simple kid, growing up in the heat and desert of West Texas, in a city or town at that time, now it's a city maybe, it was a town called Midland, interacting with my family as best as I could in light of the different personalities of my parents, my three sisters, and getting to know my friends, playing a lot of tennis, and going to school there in Midland through ninth grade. My growth in knowledge and pursuit of truth, I would call just kind of plain vanilla absorption of study materials and homework within school, with occasional learning from other experiences in life, but none particularly radical, earth-shattering, or profound. I did attend a Presbyterian church in Midland, but I can't remember a thing I learned in Sunday school. Except in fifth grade, I did have an interesting experience that was probably some sort of milestone for me. I was almost kicked out of Sunday school for asking too many questions. Again, I don't remember what the questions were, but I do remember being taken outside the Sunday school room and being told by the teacher not to be so disruptive with my questions. Now, as I look back on that experience, I realize that I did have more curiosity about life than maybe the rest of my childhood showed, so that was actually the barest of beginnings of my philosophical pursuits. It's just too bad that my Sunday school teacher wasn't more interested in allowing me to explore religious and biblical ideas. That would have to come later. In the meantime, I went away to New Jersey for 4 years of high school to a boarding school, which only accelerated my absorption of information presented to me. But interestingly enough, only a certain kind of information. The more highly structured the material was, the better. Even a math teacher there at the boarding school told my parents on Parents' Day, when they were visiting one time, that I was really good at memorizing mathematical formulas and theorems, but not so good at understanding the formulas and the theorems. So I was also good at memorizing historical facts and notions presented in novels, the books that we read in English classes, just simply in order to regurgitate all of that information on exams. But I was not very good at connecting the dots of the ideas of life, seeing the overall meaning and significance of all the structured ideas that I was absorbing. And without going into detail, the reason for this was not just an intellectual one, but it was probably more importantly a psychological and an emotional one because of my family upbringing. And I only mention this because as each of us considers his or her intellectual journey, we cannot help but face into the fact that life's experiences within our families, amongst our friends, within our church communities, at school, Gutenberg College, and within the world will affect to some degree what intellectual material we are even willing to interact with and how we will interact with that material. So I just simply ask you to consider this for your own lives. But my issues, to use a word that I'm sure that all of us are familiar with, stunted my growth in understanding how to connect the dots of life and my growth even in asking questions about life and God. I would have to say that I believed in God because it just didn't make sense to me how all this stuff came into existence. But I really wasn't very savvy about life and what it's all about. I can now say, though, that the plausibility of a creator is the very foundation for acquiring truth. So I muddled along during my high school years, studying hard at the boarding school because there really wasn't much else to do in New Jersey, especially in cold, wintry days like these in Eugene, but not making any real advancements in my acquisition of any foundational truth for life. There was a brief spike on the screen, though, in the summer of my sophomore year when I read Eric von Daniken's Chariots of the Gods. I remember being impressed with his argument that we have been visited by extraterrestrial beings and have even come from them too. In fact, he referred to several passages in the Bible and interpreted them as referring to extraterrestrial beings, implying, I think, that God really was behind it all. Now that I look back on that event in my life, I see that my response to that book revealed a hunger in my soul and in my mind to be able to describe reality, particularly the reality that extends beyond me into the rest of the cosmos and all the way to God. So that was good, because for the first time in my life, I really did start to think about reality beyond myself. I was slowly climbing out of simply memorizing ideas to wondering how those ideas relate to one another and to life. But extraterrestrial beings, well, hey, you got to start somewhere. So then on to college. I left boarding school on the East Coast and headed west in search of warmer weather. And I landed in the San Francisco Bay Area at Stanford and immediately dove into the academic and athletic environments there. And I have to say, I loved it. But my freshman year was still an emotional and relational disaster when I ended up becoming completely self-absorbed. So that I told my parents that the following year I was going to get a single apartment and all I was going to do was study my books, go to tennis practice, and that was it. But as fate would have it, before the end of my freshman year, I joined a fraternity. And the next year, my sophomore year, while living in the fraternity of all the places in the world, I became a Christian. During an Easter sunrise service that my Christian roommate dragged me to in the spring of 1973. My roommate had also given me the book, The Late Great Planet Earth by Hal Lindsey, to read over spring break. And reading about the second coming of Christ literally scared the living daylights out of me. But there wasn't anything particularly impressive about my conversion as far as real intellectual struggles go. All of a sudden, Christianity made sense to me. And now I can explain why it did. From the Bible's explanation of what happens when God regenerates a human being and persuades a human being that Christianity really is true. That's what happened to me. And for the rest of my college career, I was okay with a brand of Christianity I was being exposed to on a regular basis at a local church there in Palo Alto that one could label as an evangelical or slightly victorious Christian life-ish church, where the focus was on how to appropriate God's power in order to live in obedience to God and to enjoy life to its fullest in this realm. And now on to adulthood, if I can say that I've actually become an adult. Then at the age of 26, after having gotten married and living in Southern California, I made what would end up becoming a truly life-changing decision to attend a pastoral training program at that same church in Palo Alto that I'd been attending after I became a Christian there at Stanford. And this started a process that I am still experiencing today, and which is at the heart of the story of my intellectual journey, and which has resulted in my coming to grips with the vicissitudes of human knowledge, mine and everyone else's, and that I hope will both round out my story and be of benefit to you. Also, after my wife and I decided to leave Southern California, where I had moved after Stanford to work for Hewlett-Packard, since electrical engineering was my major, someone in Southern California gave me Lorraine Bettner's book, The Reformed Doctrine of Predestination. This, too, was a decisive experience in my journey. Remember that I was the young boy who had trouble connecting the dots of life and preferred to be in a community where everything was highly structured, including the information that I was absorbing as knowledge. Now, while I learned from the book, The Reformed Doctrine of Predestination, that Reformed or Calvinistic doctrine is highly structured, I also came to realize that there are strong disagreements between Christians on various biblical topics and issues, including God's sovereignty and man's free will. And so the question for me became mainly, which Christianity is true? Along with, why is Christianity true as opposed to any other religion or worldview that exists out there in our world, including one that would suggest that we come from extraterrestrial beings. But in addition, one of the fundamental questions for me was, am I willing to pursue understanding Christianity as it really is presented in the biblical texts, even if it means disagreeing with other Christians on what Christianity is and experiencing the consequences of these disagreements. Now, while going through the pastoral training program at the church in Palo Alto, there just happened to be a theological controversy regarding the sovereignty of God that took place at that church, and that resulted in some of the teachers of the pastoral training program I was involved in having to leave that church. And I found myself siding theologically with those who left. And in my disappointment over the whole situation, I wrote a long letter to the 15 pastors and the 12 or so elders of that church, asking each one to meet with me individually and answer each of the 35 questions that I posed to them in that letter. I wish I still had a copy of that letter, but I don't, unfortunately. But can you hear, though, what I was basically asking them to do? I was saying to them, prove your position. Show me in the Bible how you arrive at your conclusions that are different from those with whom I happen to agree who've left the church. It was this situation that finally jarred me loose from remaining comfortable in a completely structured environment of memorizing mathematical formulas, historical facts, and even theological doctrines, so that I allowed myself to give in to the hunger to know as well as possible how to understand reality, particularly the biblically explained reality. Now, since then, I've moved back down to Southern California, got involved in business for 8 years, and helped out at a local non-denominational church with some of the teaching there at the church. I also stayed in touch with the teachers who had left the church in Palo Alto because of the theological controversy. Some of your teachers and tutors here at Gutenberg College, and that's why I have this connection here at Gutenberg College. But during the next 20 or plus years, I read voraciously, hoping to learn as much as I could about history, especially church history, and philosophy, whatever that is. Honestly, I didn't really even know what it was, not sure I still know today. All I knew was is that I wanted to know what is philosophy, and I also wanted to know the Bible. So I have studied the Bible as aggressively as I can the last 20 or so years too. Eventually, I got involved in teaching full-time at a church until last December, when I left the church in order to pursue a method of teaching the Bible that is along the lines of your education here at Gutenberg College, what I would describe as shared exploration, with the Bible as our only authority and not other human beings, even theologians and Bible scholars, in order to respect the right of each individual to arrive at his or her own conclusion as to what the truth is. And over the course of 7 years, from 1993 to 1999, I acquired a master's degree in theology at Fuller Theological Seminary in Pasadena. And there are two stories that I want to relate to you from that period of my life. I had signed up for a three-part series in systematic theology at Fuller. And during the first class, I was listening to the professor, and not very much of what he was saying was making any sense at all. So I raised my hand, and I asked him, "Do you believe that God can violate the law of non-contradiction?" And he said, "Yes." Well, that was really helpful. So from that point on, for the next three quarters, I was able to sit back and relax and realize that nothing that came out of his mouth was going to have to make any sense. All I was going to have to do is just simply put it down on paper and then make sure that I was able to, you know, read it back to him or say it back to him, so to speak, on the exams. But interestingly enough, he responded to one of the papers that I wrote in a class, "This is the most logical explanation of this subject that I have ever read," is what he wrote on my paper. And I wanted to say to him, "So? I didn't think logic was relevant to you." But also during my years at Fuller, someone arranged for me to have breakfast one time with R.C. Sproul, one of my heroes. He looked fairly bored, I have to admit, at the beginning of our conversation, probably thinking, you know, just sort of, this is a perfunctory breakfast, just needed to get through it. You know, okay, this young man, he just wants to be able to say he had breakfast with R.C. Sproul. Maybe he's got a few questions, what have you. But eventually, I said to him, I'd like to ask you a question. And I could tell in his eyes, he's probably thinking, okay, it's probably going to be about, you know, communion or baptism or some doctrinal issue. But I asked him the same question I'd asked the professor at Fuller. Dr. Sproul, do you think that God can violate the law of non-contradiction? And he lit up. And we talked for the next 2 hours about the importance of God's rationality and the importance of understanding that logic is at the very fabric, is part of the very fabric of truth. And with his lamenting the fact that so many professors in seminaries where with whom he was in contact have given up on the whole notion of God's rationality and logic. Now, I mentioned these two stories to you to point out that an aspect of the vicissitudes of human knowledge is disagreement on the importance of rationality and logic, which we simply need to take into account as we are on our own intellectual journeys in our discovery of truth. And part of the reason that I went to Fuller was because I was afraid that at any other seminary, if I asked the kinds of questions that I was asking, I would run into too much resistance even to be able to finish my degree. But all the experiences, both inside and outside of my classes, contributed to where I was heading, to my main point, to the vicissitudes of human knowledge. So here's the thing. Intuitively, for the last 25 years, I've realized that truth is there for us to acquire and understand. But it's neither easy nor straightforward as far as the process of acquiring it is concerned. And the key word here is process. Through my continued relationship with what was originally McKinsey Study Center under Wes Hurd and now Gutenberg College with all of your tutors, I've been exposed to and read many of the same texts that you read here in your 4 years of school, those of you at least that are in school here. I also took a three-part series in the history of philosophy at UC Irvine about 10 years ago. In this last November, November 7th to be exact, I think, I sat in on two classes here at Gutenberg when I came up for a board meeting, a biblical philosophy class and one where you all in the class were reading Kant's Prolegomena to Any Future Metaphysics. Surprised I could even pronounce that. Listening to you all discuss these topics motivated me to reread many of the important recent philosophers, starting with René Descartes and going right on up through Michael Polanyi. I did buy Kant's Prolegomena to Any Future Metaphysics. I started reading it, and one of these days I hope to finish it, and I might even understand a little bit of what he said. But as I have reread these philosophers, I was struck with how all of them disagree with one another on their descriptions of human knowledge in reality. And as I listen to Bible teachers and talk with other Christians, I realize that all of them disagree with one another too, especially if they are in different Christian communities or come from different Christian communities. Now, we might find a few Christians in a particular church who agree on just about everything, but I think it really will be only a few. I see this also in the Bible studies that I teach now, 5 a week. So 5 opportunities each week to listen to people talk about their theology and reveal their presuppositions and their assumptions about reality and about the Bible. Because the format is discussion format, like your classes here, most of your classes at Gutenberg, where everyone is involved in the conversation and in helping one another to understand what the biblical author is seeking to communicate. But the wide variety of perspectives on a particular word, on a phrase, on a sentence, on a paragraph is always quite amazing to me. But it's also confirming what I have come to grips with over time in my own pursuit of truth. That Christianity is indeed plausible, but no one seems to agree on exactly what it is, this thing called Christianity. And this is okay. It has to be because of the vicissitudes of human knowledge. And thus we all, as Christians, pursue life with however much we know to be true about Christianity. We run with what we've got, modifying along the way as we discover our errors, and adding what we feel is appropriate as we encounter new knowledge to include in our pie. Now, some of you know Moffat and Doreen Zimba, who started North Rise University in Zambia, and who used David and Jack Crabtree's and Ron Gillian's book, The Language of God, to teach on the subject of the principles of biblical interpretation. Recently, Moffat and I were discussing how he was visiting the United States, and we were discussing how helpful that book is in the midst of what he called our searching the scriptures together. Now, I love that phrase, and I camped on it as soon as Moffat said it. None of us, because we are neither Jesus nor the apostles, is an authority on truth over anyone else. We are simply searching the scriptures together and graciously helping each other on the journey of constantly modifying our pies. Yes, some people know Hebrew and Greek and the biblical languages, and some people have studied the Bible more than others. But this does not make them an authority over others. It only makes them tools for others to use while we all submit only to the authority of God and the Bible and exercise our rights and responsibilities to come to our own conclusions as to what the biblical truth is. Now, in the meantime, I still have all sorts of questions and am pursuing projects bit by bit to help answer these questions. Some of the questions are, why do our Bibles contain only the documents that they do? Dan Brown has obviously raised this issue. I'm interested in it too. I'd love to know, but I'd love to be able to say, yes, this is why only these books are included in the Bible. So I'm pursuing that project. Second question, is there really a difference between the apostles and ourselves when it comes to expecting God to perform miracles through us? I mean, I'm in conversation with my friend, but I want to get a better handle on the answer to that question than I think I have even now. Or a third question, what exactly is or are the distinguishing characteristics between a Christian and someone of another religion in this world, including the religion of science, which, thanks to Charlie Dewberry's books, I've come to recognize is truly a religion, that is, science is. Now, my sense is that the correct answer to this question is our coming to grips with at the deepest level of our beings with our sin which resides within us, as well as coming to grips with God's mercy and grace that comes to us through the life and death and resurrection of Jesus Christ in our embracing that message. But a fourth question I'm working on is, how do we live out our Christianity and allow for the tension between community, the church, and individuality? I'm ultimately responsible for only my salvation, not yours. So you are an individual living within a community. How do we live out the tension between those two? And you'll hear people talk about how community is most important. And others will say individuality is most important. I want to know, what does the Bible have to say about that tension? So let me state my main point once again then, okay, where this is all supposed to take us and what I've already said to you. Think of your knowledge as a pie chart, with most of that pie representing true and accurate knowledge of reality, regardless of who you are, Christian or non-Christian. Nevertheless, there's going to be a slice of that pie that is false knowledge. Even though we think that the entire pie, right now, I think my entire pie is true. I don't care what you say, okay? It is. We just operate that way. If I thought that any part of my pie was not true, I'd change it in order to live life better than I'm living it now. But the sizes of these slices of my knowledge pie are always changing, so that two things are true about our human knowledge. One is that as we pursue truth, and especially biblical truth, we should find the true truth that we know to be true as growing. We should also find that we're willing to change things that we thought were true, change and realize that, no, that's not true. Instead of A, it's actually B, it being true. Secondly, that we find that our knowledge is always different. My knowledge is different from yours. My pie is different from yours. Your knowledge pie is different from everyone else's in this world. And so for me to expect or demand that your knowledge pie be exactly the same as mine is completely unrealistic. Instead, we're always at different places in our intellectual journeys with respect to what we know to be true and where our knowledge pies are. And so this is what I call the vicissitudes of human knowledge, the changes that take place, as well as the differences that exist in our knowledge pies. I'm also calling this learning to live with uncertainty and error in the midst of certainty and truth. It's just by definition, some of my knowledge is not true. That makes me really nervous because I'm a perfectionist. And I always need to feel as though I'm right. And I always need to feel as though my knowledge is right. And right now I'm telling you, some of it ain't. And that makes me really, really nervous. And I don't even know what it is, which part of it isn't right. That makes me even more nervous. But that's simply the way reality is. And so we need to allow then God as the only authority in our lives through the Bible to be the one who grows us in our knowledge as well as changes our knowledge when, as in the midst of our Bible study, we discover that something that we believe to be true is actually false and we need to change our minds. So we should proclaim Jesus as Messiah, but be prepared for the vicissitudes of human knowledge in our fellow human beings as well as in ourselves. And then the sub-point that I made, that in the midst of all this, it's the pursuit of truth. While we have this inkling that, you know what, I'm not a very good person. I have this problem called sin. And fortunately, God is a merciful God who grants me his mercy and his forgiveness. And Jesus, how does he fit into this? Well, I know that he lived. I know that he died. I know that he rose from the dead, because that's what the Bible tells me. And he sits at the right hand of the Father right now. How to explain all the details of that, honestly, I can't tell you. But I have an inkling of that, and I need to run with that until I can gain a better understanding of it or change some idea of that I have that I need to change. But depending upon your own presuppositions. One other thing I want to say. Using the tool of knowledge that God has given us and understanding that knowledge, language. Using the tool of language that God has given us and understanding that language is really quite flexible, we have to realize that communicating one's view of reality is actually very difficult. It's hard to do. And because we all read into words particular meanings based upon our own assumptions about reality and about those words. For example, after I had taught one Sunday morning at the church where I used to work, and I had said nothing, but nothing, about marriage or divorce, a woman in the audience who had recently gone through a divorce walked up to me afterwards and said, "I get it. I need to go back to my maiden name." I just stood there stunned. I had no idea where she got that. But she had read into whatever I had said what she simply wanted to hear. That just happens. That's part of the way the communication works, is that we all do that. So depending upon your own presuppositions in your journey in acquiring human knowledge, you may or may not have connected the dots of what I have talked about tonight exactly as I have in my own mind. We just have to allow for this. And this is why it's always good to have a discussion. which can help clarify the dots in their connections, and be patient with one another in our growth and changing our knowledge and understanding. And so, if you would like, let's talk. If you have any questions or comments, I'd love to hear them. Yes?
Okay. I like the idea of the pie chart and, you know, talking about how each of us, if we're honest, will say, not only is there something here that's not true, but I don't know what it is. Okay. So I liked what you said that, you know, we have to respect the right of every individual to come to their decision about what the truth is. But I guess for me, you put in, you know, in regards with God, standing before God, and through the authority of the Bible, well, you could sort of question whether that's the logical conclusion, sure, or that actually you would have to open it up entirely and say it's the right of every individual before whatever they believe in terms of truth or God, to come to the conclusion about what God is or reality without putting the Bible in there or even Christianity. And I just was kind of wondering what your thoughts on that would be.
Well, that could be, I think you could be referring to my first question that where I was asking about, you know, why these particular documents in our Bible, and then to hitchhike on that, you know, why is the Bible our authority? How can I claim that to be the case? And that's a very good question, because obviously I'm assuming in my talk that it is.
That's part of the true truth.
That's
real truth.
Right.
Whereas, you know, obviously someone could question, well, maybe that's the part where you are blind.
Correct.
Because for whatever reason, you feel like you need to, you know, believe that.
That's
and
right.
They could, you know, and so I just think it's an interesting concept. Once we all acknowledge that there's aspects in our knowledge which are not true, however large or small or here or there, then it kind of opens it up.
It does tend to open it up. I agree. Well said.
Thanks.
Anyone else? Yes, back there. Maybe if you could wait for the microphone. The microphone's come. Well, just for the recording, I think, is what they want.
I'm being recorded, huh? Well, just going along with what Pavan said, then, well, why do you believe that? Then why do you take the Bible as authority?
Why do I take the Bible as true truth? Because it's plausible? Next question. It makes sense because of, as far as I can tell, the history of the world has included a man by the name of Jesus of Nazareth, and the accounts that we have in the Bible of his life and his words seem to be true, not only just from a historical standpoint, but even also from a subjective one. They ring true with whom I see myself to be as someone who stands in need of the mercy of God. And so the story just all seems to make sense, and that's maybe about as well as I can do, as good as I can do right now. Still working on that. I'll keep working on that one now. Another question up here. Unless there's one back there.
Can you talk?
It's actually on.
It is on.
Yeah,
the sound?
It's on. But
okay.
Yeah, it's just for the recording.
Can you talk a little bit about how you understand rationality and how that might connect or differentiated from other sort of kinds of knowledge? For example, you used the word intuition at one point.
Yeah.
You talk about process. So in particular, because you honed in on rationality,
yeah,
and yet you did use other things. I'm curious kind of
okay.
How you see those different
okay.
facets.
I see rationality much the same way that Aristotle did, and maybe exactly the same way, where he simply described rationality using the so-called laws of logic, the law of non-contradiction, the law of identity, the law of excluded middle, that a rose is a rose is a rose a rose cannot be both a rose and not a rose at the same time and in the same respect. That those kinds of notions are what basically end up being what we would call based upon rationality, which is part of the very fabric of our being, because that's how God has made us, who ultimately is rationality with a capital R, or logic with a capital L. So that even if I'm using my intuition is not something separate from or different from my rationality. It's using my rationality, but in a way where I may not be actually cognizant of the actual steps that I'm taking intellectually to go from A to B. It just, something just seems to happen where I can go from A to B, and I couldn't even tell you how I got there. I just intuit that process, that journey, those notions, and draw conclusions. But to slow down my thinking well enough to be able to tell you exactly how I did that, probably can't do. I know I can't do that all the time. Sometimes I can do that. But nevertheless, what is happening, though, is that I am using the innate, ingrained trying to think of another adjective here, but it's just the very fabric of my being. I'm using that in my thought process. That's what I would call rationality. That if
can I come back
please,
to that?
Please, keep going.
How then, I mean, you talked a lot, which I think was really valuable, and I think a lot of us at some point in life come and face that whole issue of, you know, that we have to change what we understand, or we come to realize, wait a minute, it's not quite, you know, that as we grow and change the way we think about or understand truth over time. You're talking, I guess my question is about how much are we aware of, follows up on Pavan's question, how much are we aware of what we know is more or less solid than something else? For example, how do we know if we should even trust our intuition? Because our intuition, which is much less conscious than other aspects of our thinking, may be completely flawed by our sin and by all sorts of whatever. And if I can say, if I understand, you're sort of saying we don't know how we can trust our intuition, and maybe we even shouldn't trust our intuition, but we keep going. So I guess
this is what I think I'm learning about human knowledge as I think about my own mind and try to reflect upon it. And I was just rereading Thomas Reed, who, in critiquing René Descartes, says that, you know, there are two kinds of ways of trying to come to an understanding of one's human knowledge, what he calls the way of reflection and the way of analogy. And he says the way of reflection really is the better of the two ways, but it's also the more arduous. It's difficult. It requires one to really think rather than just maybe say, well, human knowledge is like such and such, as opposed to saying, no, human knowledge is, and then really try to fill in the blank and be very descriptive about what human knowledge is. But all that to say that as I try to use that process, okay, Thomas, you know, here I go. I'll try to be really reflective on what's going on in my human mind. I'm going, whoa. You know, even if, you know, no matter who a person is, the human mind is just this incredible instrument that we have, that to try to describe all that's going on, exactly what's happening, probably is just, it is indescribable, completely indescribable. That is, one cannot describe it completely. And so it is hard. And therefore, if one is going to say, no, I really think that this watch is here. Well, how do you know that watch is? Well, I mean, I'm touching it, for crying out loud. I picked it up. I mean, what else am I going to do but just trust the fact that I think the stupid thing's here? Well, how do you know God is it? Well, I mean, where else does this stuff come from? Give me a better answer, you know, a better answer than God. Or how do you know that the Bible is true? Well, I thought about it as best as I can, and it seems to make sense to me. And if someone could argue otherwise and show me that the Bible should not be trusted, I'd have to run with that. and show me that Christianity is false and some other religion is true, I'd have to run with that if I'm going to be honest with my own self about the value and importance of my own mind and of rationality itself. So I'm sure that's not a very satisfying answer to you, but it's the best answer that I can give is that, yeah, you just we're intuiting or whatever the word would be, and we're thinking and we're coming to conclusions as best we can, and that's why I threw in that notion of humility there too. Also, hopefully with great humility, I may be wrong, and if I'm wrong, well, shoot, show me, and then I need to change my mind if I'm going to also be true to rationality, which suggests humility for human beings made in the image of God, especially human beings who are sinners, and where sin, as you even said, can get in the way of our thinking processes too. So. Yes? No? Do you have a question?
No.
No, okay. Okay, oh, sorry. Anyone else? Yes, one in the back. Oh, no, Carrie, go ahead. Sorry.
Okay, so I think this is something that we've already sort of touched on, but I think this may be a slightly different part of it, and I think you will understand this coming from, like, the perfectionist side and
okay.
different things. But how do you become okay, I guess, with the fact that knowing that some of the things you believe now may be totally false, and looking back at your experience and going, I believe that at one point, and I know now that that was crazy, but yet I thought that that was true. How do you be okay with that? And how do you deal with that, like, on a daily basis and moving forward with your life? And
well, a couple of things that one could do. You could put yourself in a situation where you get really beat up. That helps. I'm serious. You know I am, right? Okay. Because that forces you to be cognizant of the fact that you really are very mortal and emotional and psychological and spiritual. And you combine all that stuff together along with your moral condition before God, created by the moral creator. And you realize that you're a clay pot in the hands of a sovereign creator, along with all these other clay pots in this world, and you're bumping into one another and colliding with each other physically, intellectually, morally, spiritually, doctrinally, psychologically, and all of that, all those collisions and all those interactions just reduce you to the level where you go, all I can do is be on my knees and say, God, here's where I am. And if you need me, want me to be in a different place, great, take me there. But here's where I am right now. This is what I really believe to be true. But I'm willing to see myself as someone made by you who's on a journey. And one of these days you're going to get me to the end of the journey where I step into heaven. And I don't even think that we'll have necessarily all, our knowledge may be correct then, but it may not be complete. So we'll still be growing in our knowledge in heaven. So if that's the journey that I'm on, well, then I can just relax and allow myself to be someone who's strictly on a journey and doesn't have to arrive right now, because I certainly haven't arrived morally. So why should I put such pressure on myself to arrive intellectually too? That's what helps me.
It's two things. It's really humbling, and it's also really difficult. I mean, like I said, going through stuff that's difficult and being face to face with knowing and, like, this level of humanity, morally and intellectually, that I don't have it all together, and it's not as defined as I thought it was. Mm. It's really, you know, I don't have a whole lot of brilliant things to say about it, but it's just...
Well, I think it's brilliant that you're saying, and very honest that you're saying it's humbling. I totally agree with you. Coming face to face with other people's humanity that then allows me to come face to face with my own humanity is extremely humbling. nothing could better could happen to us in our lives if we can just get a handle on that, which I think is part of the process that God has us in as Christians, to push us into that place where we can allow ourselves really to be human instead of feeling as though we need to be superhuman. So I completely agree with you. I think that's good. Thanks.
So when you talked about just thinking that, like, God is a rational God and a logical God, so I'm assuming that also implies that he made us in that way too, right? And, like, everything that's in the world. So does that also imply that there is no concept to which, like, I guess in thinking about some of the things, like, that the church especially has attributed to God and just, like, that don't really make sense in any way, and just saying, like, well, you have to have faith. Like, so is that also implying that God, because he's a logical and rational God, doesn't, like, he didn't really make a concept for us that we wouldn't understand because we also have a logical and rational mind? Or, like, does it also leave room for God to have concepts or ideas or anything in the world which we can't comprehend or, like, doesn't seem logical or rational? Does that make sense at all?
I think so.
Okay.
Let me see if this is an answer to your question, if I caught it. I think we need to make a distinction between rational versus irrational and easy to understand versus difficult to understand. Did I say that right? We need to make a difference. God is a rational God, and every concept of truth, I think, is a rational concept. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be easy to understand. Take quantum mechanics, for example. I think quantum mechanics, if it's correct, Charlie, where are you? Are rational concepts, quantum mechanics are. But I have great difficulty understanding them. I've taken a class in quantum mechanics, and I memorized every cotton pick and stinking formula, and I got an A in the class, but I did not understand really what I was even learning. So the formulas were easy to memorize, but the concepts of the formulas we're describing were very difficult to understand. So all truth is rational, but not necessarily easy to understand. So, and I think that there will be things even in eternity that we will have great difficulty comprehending, even though we'll be able to trust the fact that those concepts are rational concepts. Did that answer your question?
I think so. Like, for example, like, just how you talked about in eternity, is that the word you used? Or
sure.
Infinity, I forgot.
Eternal life, yeah.
Well, whichever one.
Yeah, either one, yeah. It's fine.
So, I mean, that seems to be a pretty hard thing to comprehend, like, in our minds. Mm. But so are you, like... But you just, it's still not illogical in the sense that, like, it's not contradictory to logic? Or what do you mean by, like, it's still a rational thing? Like, are you saying that there is no thing that God made that is, irrational, like, that just because we can't grasp it with our minds at a certain time, like, it still doesn't make it irrational?
I think so. I think we can think irrational thoughts. Let's say, for example, I think the thought, God is evil. That would be an irrational thought because it doesn't make sense. It's not true. It's the very opposite of truth. So I can think an irrational thought.
Okay. Could you explain then, like, how if we can't grasp a certain term, like, how we can tell that we can't grasp it because it's hard to grasp or because it's irrational?
No, I can't.
Okay.
That's what's hard. Because that's what I have to keep working at. Let's take quantum mechanics, for example, or the special theory of relativity. How do I know that it's a rational concept? Not until maybe I really have actually grasped it and comprehended it would I be able to tell so. But how do I know when I've actually comprehended it? Well, I just kind of have this hunch, this intuition that I think I've arrived there. Have I? Not sure. Well, I think so. Those also maybe we could include it. I didn't necessarily think about including these sorts of things in the vicissitudes of human knowledge, but we could, kind of the these problematic aspects of human knowledge. So.
All right, I think that makes sense.
Okay,
thanks.
Yeah.
Whew,
made it to that one. All right, got a question up here. And then, was that you, Ron? Oh, back there, okay.
Don't mind me while I just look to the napkin here. I wrote my question down.
That's all right. I was looking at my notes all night long, so you're welcome to look at your napkin.
All right. I wrote, it seems as if you are holding rationality, the self, or reason as God in a sense. That is quite different from the understanding that reason is incomplete and is in need of revelation to see things even so dimly as we do now. Because God came into history for his purpose and to be able to be revealed to us Gentiles in a fuller way than the Old Testament era. So how do these two things match up?
Okay, if I understand your question, I think you're asking about human reason, right?
Yes.
And its need for revelation from a reasonable God. That'd be a way of saying it? Now that's because that's what I'd like to do. That's the direction I'd like to go, is that God is reason with a capital R. He is a reasonable God who is rationality personified. We are reasonable human beings in that he has implanted in us the very principles of logic and rationality so that you and I can look at one another and go, wow, you exist? I exist. Yeah, how about that? Son of a gun, can you believe it? But that doesn't necessarily mean that as I look around this world, I'm going to be able to understand all that God would really want me to understand about himself and about myself apart from his revealing that to me through a book, let's say, called the Bible. So then I would use my reason to actually read the Bible and say, look at this extra knowledge that I'm gaining about reality that I couldn't gain if all I did was walk around the world and just look at trees and plants and other kinds of things in this world.
I might be incorrect, and I don't believe the statement I'm going to make, but I don't see it, or it doesn't seem to make sense, that to say God is evil is an irrational thought or an irrational reality. I don't believe it, and it doesn't go with his character. But if I didn't have the scriptures to tell me otherwise, I don't think there would be any issue rationally with thinking God is both good or evil. And I was wondering, what do you do in situations like that? Because it doesn't seem, unless I'm crazy, which is very possible, as my classmates or teachers. But I don't think that would be irrational. And if you went to even other people, I don't think it would be an irrational idea, even though I would say the scriptures obviously say the contrary. And I believe it, that he is a good God and merciful beyond belief. But, again, without the revelation, we wouldn't be able to determined that unless it was an Abraham experience or Jacob experience or Ahab experience.
I see your point. I mean, I could conceive of a God who is evil, but whether or not that God actually exists is a whole other question. And then, so now I'm back to the Bible, right?
And that's why I was curious. We need revelation to explain reason.
Gotcha. Or to explain to us what reality is. This is the way I would say it. Maybe we're saying the same thing. To explain what reality is as we use our reason to understand that reality as presented to us by the biblical texts.
So would revelation be held lower than reason, or would it be higher than reason?
It depends upon what you're talking about. Boy, you really want to get me in trouble here too, don't you? The question, okay, the question is reason above or below revelation? If we're talking about just kind of bare bones authority, what's the higher of the two in terms of authority? I'd say the Bible is. When it comes to, well, how am I going to tell what the correct interpretation of the Bible is? I'm stuck with reason. So in a sense, then, reason is higher than the Bible when I'm actually studying the Bible, because I'm having to rely on reason in order to interpret it. But as soon as I interpret it, and I think I'm right, I'm willing to submit to its authority and say, what it's telling me is true, and so I will run with that truth, even if someone were to come along and tell me otherwise.
And I may be getting nitpicky, and I apologize, but in that instance, when you go for interpretation with your reason to the scriptures, that's when the spirit would have to be involved, because your passions or your will affect your reason greatly.
Okay.
And so, ultimately, then, doesn't it come back to, I don't know what I'm trying to say fully, but I think I'm trying to say something. I apologize. But do you understand what I'm saying at all?
I think so. Let me see if this is this would be helpful. My understanding of the Spirit's work in the process of Bible study is, I'll just lay it out there here for you. Once our reason grasps the meaning of a text, the Spirit persuades us that that interpretation is true and persuades us to run with it, to submit ourselves to it, and live our lives on the basis of it. So the Spirit doesn't actually communicate to us, oh, this is the correct interpretation, not that one. It's our minds that do that. So it's the Spirit then that convinces us, though, to embrace the truth once we've discovered it. Now, I realize that may be a little bit different from perhaps what you are used to hearing or even thinking yourselves. It is a change in my own thinking about this that I have gone through. But because here's the problem. Let's say that the Spirit is the one that tells me which is the correct interpretation and which isn't. How do I know when the Spirit's doing that? And the only answer I could come up with was, well, I just feel as though it is. Or I intuit. It's an intuition. But what do you mean by intuition? Well, it just makes sense. It's and I go back even to the word plausible. It just seems plausible. It seems reasonable. That this is what Paul means in this passage in Romans, or what Matthew means, or what Jesus means, and what he's saying.
But just to clarify, I wasn't saying that the Spirit tells you.
Okay.
What I meant by the Spirit, softens the will and the heart to be able to accept what's true.
Oh, well, then we were saying the same thing. Sorry, then I misunderstood you. I'm saying that the Spirit softens me to be willing to accept what is true, after my mind has discovered it, the truth. So that other part was for free? Okay. If you were wondering about it at all. Was there another question? Oh, yeah, back there. Sure. And by the way, this is really helpful for me. Thank you for doing this. Phew, man, I feel as though I'm under a microscope, but it's good because I just you're making me think, and that's part of my point, is that this is what it's all about. is being able to do this sort of thing so that I can clarify for myself what's going on in my own mind, and hopefully you can too. So I'd really appreciate this. Thank you. Okay. Yes, go ahead. But go ahead then.
Well, this is going to be an easy one for you, I think.
Oh, thank goodness. So, finally.
What is faith?
Didn't I have that in one of those definitions? You're right, I didn't, did I? Faith.
Seems like you talk a lot about, you know, reason and rationality.
Yes.
And
absolutely.
And I believe that that's definitely part of us as humans and given to us as a faculty or something like that, whatever you want to call it. But
okay, let me stop you right there.
Yeah.
I want to come right back at you. What do you mean, I believe that is part of our humanity? What do you mean by the word believe? I believe that it is.
Well, it seems like you're explaining a lot of things as God is rational. I think that's what you said.
No, I'm sorry. You're not understanding my question. Excuse me, you're interrupting you.
Okay.
I'm trying to... what I'm trying to do is to say that faith is believing something to be true. That's how I would define faith. So I just picked up on the fact that you actually used the very word that I would use to define faith. You were saying, well, you know, you were saying to me that, you know, you used all these terms, and yes, I believe that rationality, I think this is what you said, is part of our humanity, if I could paraphrase it that way, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that, when you said, I believe, that's faith. I believe that and that's why I asked you, what do you mean by that? Mm-hmm. So as well as you could define that term, I believe, that would be my definition of biblical faith. I believe that Jesus is the Messiah. Mm-hmm. I believe that God exists. I believe that God has created the reality. I believe that I'm a sinner. All those notions, that's, I think, what the Bible means when it uses the word faith.
So faith isn't any sort of mystical thing.
Only in the sense, again, here we go. Boy, words, mystical. Now, what do you mean by mystical? Well, faith is, belief is something mystically that does, in a sense, come about mystically because it's the Spirit of God who changes me into a person who no longer resists the truth of the Bible but is now willing to submit to it and embrace it. That is kind of mystical. I don't claim to know or to be able to, you know, necessarily draw a diagram or write out a mathematical formula that would describe that. So, but that's the only, well, only, as far as I know right now, that's maybe the only sort of mystical aspect of it. When it comes to actually believing, no, that's a very rational process that we go through in our own human minds when we say, oh boy, I believe that the gospel of Jesus Christ is true.
So being saved by faith is just being saved by our beliefs.
Correct. That where my embracing those concepts that are presented to me from the Bible about myself as an immoral being and the need for God's mercy, and I believe those, that becomes part of who I am now. I am a person who is a believer in those concepts. There's all sorts of other things that happen as a result of that, though, too. I'm also a confessor of sin. I'm also a person who pursues doing what's good and right in my life. And I'm also a person who wants to know more about the truth of the Bible. So there are other aspects to me besides just my belief that end up being part of what it means for me to be a saved person, a person who's going to be granted the promise of the eternal inheritance in heaven. But definitely that belief is a very important mark or characteristic, and that's why, say, for example, the Apostle Paul camps on it so much in Romans or Galatians. Because believing that Jesus is the Messiah, once you've encountered that message, is pretty dang important for describing you as somebody who is an authentically saved person by God.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you. I don't know exactly how long to go. It's 9 o'clock, and that's when you usually quit. Okay, then we're done. Thank you all again very much. Appreciate it.